just recap and to finish off. So we've been talking about Enoch the Mason Asma Rasha, that we seem to have a principle which is probably close to unanimous. Maybe it's a little bit disputed among the Tannaim. That's how some of the Rishonim discuss, others deny that it's disputed at all. But there is a principle of Enoch the Mason Asma Rasha, which seems to mean at least that a person is not credible if he wants to incriminate himself. But it seems like it could be a little bit of a broader principle that we find in our Gemara, especially that it's applied pretty broadly, because here we're talking about Adnan saying that a shtar is no good because they were hustled when they signed the shtar. So there, one really could say that, let's say that should be believed, because even if they're incriminating themselves, we're not interested in the incrimination. And we don't even care about anybody's incrimination. All we care about is that the shtar doesn't have Aiden. So one could really make a case that if we're ever going to bifurcate the testimony, we should do it here. So it's interesting, our Gemara is a somewhat more extreme case, while we find other Gemaras which are much more focused. For example, the possibility in the Gemara in Yevamos that one could testify that he killed someone's husband, and that woman might be able to remarry, at least according to one possible opinion of the Gemara, the woman might be able to remarry based on that testimony, even though the person is acknowledging being a murderer. So we have to figure out exactly what are the parameters, when can you bifurcate the testimony, and when can you not. And we saw that the Tosfos tries a little bit to give somewhat of a distinction between different situations, and Tosfos suggests that our sugya, this is a really important thing to come in mind, to keep in mind, that our sugya is not only complicated by issues of Einar the Mason Asma Rasha. But our sugya has, that certainly is mentioned, but its real issue is coming from somewhere else. Its real issue is that we're talking about Kiyum Shtaros, that the need is to uphold the Shtar, and that need is only Midrabanan. That Menhatoru, the Shtar, is valid, and it's only that the rabbis assign a obligation to have it upheld. So that obligation is on a lower level, and that the default really is that it's kosher. And you need a higher threshold then to overcome that, so that's going to play a role here as well. That we're not going to be so quick to accept the accusation of the witnesses that the shtar is no good, when we also have a complicating factor of Einar the Mason Asma Rasha there. So far so good, everyone basically on board. So within that, we also consider, you know, what is the issue with, you know, the Mason Masmo Rasha? Why is it a problem? Why is it that we can't accept the testimony? So the Gemara and the Rashi do mention the factor of Adam Karo Veitzel Atzmo, that a person should be disqualified from testifying about himself because he is a relative of himself. Presumably, we don't mean to say that, oh, he's related to himself in any kind of a strange family tree way. We mean to say that whatever issue there is with relatives is certainly applicable to one's own self, and therefore there is an inherent soul. But there are other possibilities as well. So we mentioned, for example, how some Achronim suggest that essentially it's a paradox. You can't say that we will assign you a status of Rasha and at the same time believe your testimony about yourself as a Rasha. And therefore, the whole thing has to be thrown out. We discussed that there were some who said that it was an issue of going against Yecheskes Kashrus, which is a little bit tricky because any aid about anybody else is going to be going against their Yecheskes Kashrus, so why is it more of a problem when you're talking about yourself? But in that context, we noted also that our sugya is particularly receptive to this, because our sugya, again, dealing with a shtar, and to tie this right back into the issues that we saw about the unique properties of a shtar, that a shtar has, among its many factors, that it testifies to its own kashrus, meaning therefore it testifies also to the kashrus of the witnesses. So you have a bigger burden. This is not simply any individual coming and saying, I'm a bad guy, and he's working against his own cheskes kashrus. He is arguing against the fact that is testified by the shtar that he was kosher at that time, and therefore the burden becomes higher. Which means then, you know, the phrase used here is a little bit imprecise. It's kind of an overlap when the Gemara invokes Einot Demesim Atzma Rasha, it's really saying that it's not the general principle of Einot Demesim Atzma Rasha. It means that together with that general hesitancy to allow someone to label himself a Rasha, the real issue here is even more than that. That the Shkar itself makes it more difficult to make that point. Okay, so far so good. And there was also a suggestion that came about with free talking, that you know, maybe there is something inherent that the individual should not be allowed to incriminate himself, maybe as some type of a protection. I provided a helpful Rambam to that effect, that the Rambam also notes that maybe we're worried that somebody is essentially suicidal and is trying to use the system to inflict punishment upon himself. That is not warranted, and therefore we don't allow it across the board. You could phrase it that way, or you could phrase it as we discussed last week, that maybe it's one of the many benefits that we give the accused. In general, the halacha has a whole list of preferences that are given to the accused, and this might be one of them, that we don't allow him to be pressured into incriminating himself, and the way we stop that from happening is by not accepting it no matter what, that we basically consider it all off limits, that no matter what you say is not going to be accepted, so then you're certainly not going to be forced to incriminate yourself. So all of those were possible approaches as to why this whole issue exists. So there are a number of other questions that are considered the halacha, which might be affected by these issues. Sal?
Do we ever discuss the approach that maybe, we might have already said this, I just remember, if a guy says statement A, and then he says statement B, the statement B comes and retracts statement A due to it being a lie or whatever sort of onus, right? I mean, due to it being some sort of a lie, right? Then that really, what he's basically saying is he's falsifying statement A, therefore, once he's unreliable, then why should we believe his statement B, which falsifies statement A?
Right, so that has two points of relevance to our sugya. One is it's a whole other sugya, which that's what I want to fill in next week a little bit, the inherent ages issue of Kevin Shahigi Shivin Khazir Magid, that it's a principle of Aedis that once an aid says something, so we don't believe his retraction later. So that's certainly a play here. That's explicitly part of this sugya, and that we will come back to. And that might be very much, you know, the whole essence of what's at play here with our Mishnah. But the other part of what you're saying is, I think, the story that was mentioned a few minutes ago, that it's kind of paradoxical. We can't both hostile you based on your testimony and believe you. So you have to be one or the other.
Right.
You're either a credible witness or you're not. So if you're a credible witness, then you're not hostile. If you're hostile, then we don't believe you.
When you just let things stand from where you
were. Right, which is
that
which would come out the same way. Right.
Okay.
So that's certainly a possible start. So some of the theoretical questions that are considered that draw on some of these issues. So first of all, what if there is, the Mishnah Melech discusses, what if there is an umdana? What if we don't need this guy's testimony? Right? What if there is an umdana that we happen to know from other places that he has, that he is a Rasha? So should we accept also his testimony? Essentially, let's say the umdana wouldn't have been enough to convict him by himself, but we have an external ne'amanus, essentially, that supports it. And presumably not just in a weak way, but in a strong way. So would that make a difference? Should we say that it's about simply his credibility? He doesn't have enough credibility to do this, but some external basis would make that believe? Or should we say that, no, there's some kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card here, essentially, that we're not going to believe him when he incriminates himself, no matter what? What if it's a matter of the level of guilt rather than the aveir itself? Let's say, for example, we know that the aveir happened, and it's a question of whether it was a shogeg or a mazid. So let's say he comes and claims he's a mazid, and otherwise we think he's a shogeg. So should we believe that? That was also a suffix in the Achronim, which is interesting, because just to find some parallels to some of these questions, there is a discussion whether or not that qualifies in terms of dam l'chatzos. When you say you have an obligation, you must be shet, and has a tshuva, when he says you have to be dam l'chatzos, so does that mean you have to assume the avera didn't happen? Or if you assume that an avera was b'shogeg rather than b'mezid? Which in that case, I think it's very mustaber that that does fall under the rubric of dam l'chatzos. another question, which has parallels in other areas of halacha, is what if a person who's admitting something doesn't know that it's an aver? So if somebody admits to doing something which happens to be an avera, and this person doesn't know that that's an avera, so should we believe that? It's also a discussion in Mishnah Melach. Why should that make a difference?
Because there's no there's no hurting yourself.
Maybe, assuming that he would get off the hook for that.
He doesn't think that he's making himself rushed, so
So is that dependent on the assumption that he actually would not be considered a rusher because it was a shogeg? Maybe. Maury?
We gave one of the explanations that he had a maximum to rusher, that one of the default benefits that he had, because, for instance, if the idea was that we don't want to pressure him, so here he wouldn't have been pressured. Maybe when he finally did give some testimony that incriminated himself, so maybe that wouldn't be disqualified. But then that testimony never came from any pressure to begin with.
Maybe, except that maybe we should say that it doesn't matter that the actual... It's probably the case that we don't care whether this came from any pressure. The point is that because we want to protect him against pressure, if the story is true, it's speculative, that because we want to protect him from such pressure, we say across the board we won't accept any such thing. So maybe you could say, all right, so then maybe that across the board policy should only apply to things that actually would be acknowledgement of guilt, perhaps. And maybe this should be an exception. Maybe. The guy who was up first?
But if he didn't know it was an Avera, then Arye's Rambam would kind of go outside, to go out the window, because then the Rambam
then brought that. Yeah, I know. That's the imagery.
Then there's no longer I'm trying to kill myself. He doesn't even know it's an Avera.
Well, I think the point is, the point with both Morty's point and Arye's point, whether we say that it's Arye's Rambam about protecting himself from self-destructive tendencies, or whether it's a general benefit against pressure or anything related to that, I think we have to agree no matter what that the specific case doesn't have to fit that paradigm. It could be that we're making an absolute policy to prevent these things from happening, that because we want to be on the lookout for people abusing the system to hurt themselves, or because we want to be on the lookout for people being pressured to condemn themselves against the benefit of the Torah, so then we'll say across the board, no matter what, the option just doesn't exist. No matter what you say, we're not going to listen to you.
But in general, don't we always counter in category of Amaretz?
And therefore, how would that...
saying in this case, that's what Amaretz would be. Meaning, yes, the rule would be X, Y, or Z, but I'm saying based on the reasons, Amaretz wouldn't apply to Amaretz.
I don't know if that necessarily follows. I mean, we have to say that it's separated from the reason one way or another, because most of the cases of Einat HaMesim Ma'atzma Rasha clearly apply outside of these circumstances. Right? Clearly apply in circumstances where the Rambam Arye was quoting don't necessarily apply, and clearly apply in situations where it's not that we're worried about him violating a right that he has. The question is that maybe it's a policy across the board that we want to make this completely off the table, because that way, and the Torah, the intent of the Torah is to make this completely off the table, because otherwise it will have other consequences. Which you find parallels to this in American law, right? The whole idea that if somebody confesses without having his rights read to him, Miranda rights, things like that, or an unlawful search, that we have all kinds of essentially penalties in American law. Fruit of the poison tree, as they call it,
that's Dutch. Because if you don't read it, if he says it, he can incriminate. He can't incriminate himself as long as he wasn't pressured to give it.
Right, but I'm not just talking about the Fifth Amendment, which there may be some parallels also to the Fifth Amendment, but I'm saying other things, that there are times when your whole conviction could get thrown out, even if it's a legitimate conviction, but because we're protecting a certain right, and we're saying that across the board, it just can't happen like this because we have to allow this to exist as a right, even in other circumstances. So that could be. Hi.
In the case where he wants to remarry the woman after he admits that he murdered the husband,
mm-hmm.
It seems like if he didn't understand that he didn't have intention to necessarily want to marry her when he's admitting this, Mm-hmm. It could be that he doesn't, if he doesn't understand what he's doing wrong or anything like that. So maybe we wouldn't make it possible for to marry that woman, perhaps.
You see,
it would affect that, other things.
You say that based on the Gemara and your bones.
Yes.
But
meaning it might not have an effect on whether he's considered a murderer, but it might affect
the nature of the testimony.
Right.
So it's true. It's also important to clarify that in that Mishnah, with the Mishnah that we borrowed from to this point, the Mishnah has a couple of different dinim which are not all about Aveiros. That the point is there in general, there are times when we're worried that if somebody wants to testify, a woman is available, that maybe we shouldn't trust his testimony because maybe he was interested in marrying her, and therefore that colors things. So that Mishnah has kind of two forces also playing. You know, one, the possible interest in marrying the woman you're testifying in, or our interest right now is when he also acknowledges an Aveira, how does that play a role? So just to mention a few more points, Urshechter has a piece in Heretz HaTzvi, where a short piece about the topic of Ein Oda Veisim Atzmo Rasha, where he emphasizes the point that it's more than an issue about Karov, even though we know the Gemara does mention Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo, and the Rashi emphasizes that Nar Tarek, but it's more than that. It's not just about the Psul Karov. It says because you find this applying to any issue of Ne'manus, even when it's not about Eidus per se. Eidus is subject to a Psul Karov, but this issue of Ein Adam Neisim Atzmo Rasha applies in areas that are not Eidus. So, for example, we find, based on our Mishnah, that Rabbi Akiva Eger and others note that even the Ne'amanus of HaPesha Aser who HaPesha Hittir seems to be subject to another Mesim and Asma Rasha. But if we assume that that's what's going on in our Mishnah, it's a Machlokes Rishonim how to read our Mishnah, but if you assume that our Mishnah is talking about that mechanism, so we find that that's not about Eidus per se, and yet apparently even there there's an issue of another Mesim and Asma Rasha. So, as he notes, it seems like it's not only about Karov, maybe there's an issue of Karov also when you're talking about Aegis. But it seems like this is a general Torah philosophy that has to do really with Onshin, which is along the lines of some of the Svaras we've been saying here. And I think I mentioned last week, and he quotes this Gemara as well, that when the Torah says, Asher Yarshiun, and so that the person is convicted by others, he shall be made into a Rasha by others, and the Gemara understands that to mean he shall be made into a Rasha by others, prat le marshia es atzmo, to exclude a situation of somebody who incriminates himself, that we have in general a Torah principle preventing self-incrimination by anything that is an onish, by anything that is a penalty. So therefore it applies on the one hand, outside of straight Eidus issues, it applies to other types of Ne'amanus as well, and it applies to anything that is punitive. So whether it's execution, whether it's labeling yourself as a Rasha, whether it's imposing a penalty on you, in all of those areas, so you have a rule of Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha. But it doesn't apply to something which is not punitive. So, for example, we have a principle of Hodas Baldin Kamei Eidin Dama. I mean, that if one of the litigants acknowledges that he is chayef a straight monetary debt, he acknowledges that he borrowed money, he acknowledges that he bought something he didn't pay for, he acknowledges that he has a straight monetary debt to someone else, so that certainly is exempted. So, he notes, Mr. Shefton notes the following, that there is a machlokas. In general, other svarim raise the question that, for example, Rabbi Chanan, that he assumes that this is a principle of Eidus. So working off that assumption, he says that if you have something which isn't about Eidus, then you do say a person can be believed even if it incriminates themselves. So for example, what if somebody makes a taina in a monetary dispute with someone else? And somebody makes a taina to get himself off the hook. But that taina will involve a self-incriminating claim. Should we accept his taina? So here, There are many Rishonim who say, yes. It's actually a Machlokas. In the ninth parak of Bava Kamma, the Hagos HaShri quotes Machlokas about this. But many Rishonim say, yes, we accept that, because it's not Eidus, it's a time. Or, what if you have a father, we know that a father is believed to claim a person as his child. To claim a son as his, we believe the father's called Yakir. It's a principle of the Marian Yavamas. So what if a father claims that somebody is his son? Let's say the father is a Kohen and the son is the son of a Grusha. So in order to make this claim, so he'd have to be acknowledging that he married a Grusha. And let's say he did so b'mezid. So he's saying he did the Avera on purpose. So again, it's Machlokas Rishonim, and you hear Yavamas quotes Machlokas about this. But if you assume that is believed, so then you could say, all right, these are not actual Eidus, these are other principles of credibility, and that's why we believe him. We believe him in a kind, and we believe him to identify his son. But Rabbi Chanan says he doesn't understand why there are Rishonim who don't accept it, why there are Rishonim who say we wouldn't believe in those two cases. Since they're not Eidus, and they're not subject to a psul of Karov, so then why should we have any problem with the Inod HaMeisim HaAtzma Rasha? Yeah, everyone follow so far?
Because it's not within the context of Eidus.
Right, he's assuming that it should only be an Eidus issue, and therefore we understand the views that are shown in that say non-Eidus situations don't have this problem. So why does any Rishon disagree with that? So if Shechter is saying differently, he's saying that it's really not about Eidus, it's about the general non-self-incrimination principle, which certainly comes up in Eidus, especially where you have the issue of Karov. But also it comes up in other areas, like Hafesh Asa, and possibly even in the area of Taina. So in discussing that, he notes, so what's not disputed? Right? So definitely, Moda, Hodos, Baldin, Kamei, Eidin, Dami, Ischayev, everyone agrees. If a litigant says, I borrowed $100 from you, yes, it's true, he's going to have to pay $100. Everyone agrees. And Moda B'Knas, everyone agrees, you're Pater. Right? Because a Knas is essentially punitive. So if you say, like our Masechta is a lot about the Knas and the Manas is a Psula. So let's say somebody says, I committed a crime for which there is a Knas, or I stole your property, so I would otherwise be obligated in Kato. He doesn't pay the kefil, he has to give back the principal. He didn't have to pay the kefil because kefil is a knas. So those two points are undisputed. That if you admit to a monetary debt, you have to pay, and you admit to a knas, you don't have to pay. What's the machlokas we just mentioned a few minutes ago? Machlokas is about something in between. That let's say you're arguing with your putter. And the reason you're pater is because of a situation in which you acknowledge an aver. So that's where you have a machlokas, is that an issue of Eino D'Meisim HaAtzma Rasha or not. So what's that machlokas about? So it's interesting. What's the difference between that and, let's say, Moda B'Mamon, where you are obligated to pay for sure? So Rav Shechter explains that thinks the difference is that if you are Moda, you have a debt. So we don't care about why. It's that once you're Moda to the debt, you're Chayav. So the Aveira itself is not a part of the process. So we can ignore your Aveira and just focus on the debt. But when you make a Taina, so, is your explanation a part of the Taina? So, if you recall, we spoke about this a few weeks ago in a different context. I'll give you a hint. We talked about Migo. Right? There was a Rambam. Here's a good Chazar opportunity. Like, do you remember we spoke about a Rambam in the context of Migo that's relevant to this? Right? The Rambam, he talks about the nature of a Taina. If you recall, the Rambam says that when you have two parties arguing, so they say, I'm chayiv, I'm pater, you're chayiv, I'm pater, whatever it is. And then we make them explain why. right? And we discussed at the time, talking about ego, that maybe the claim that you have to explain why, you have to explain your taina, maybe that's secondary. Maybe that's not really why you win or lose. So if that's the case, he says, maybe we could ask this question. So if your taina, you admit to be doing an avera, so how crucial is that to the process? Do we say that really you win or lose in a fight based on other factors and the taina is just secondary? So if you acknowledge doing an avera, it doesn't matter because the taina is not really going to make the difference one way or another. Or do we say no, that the taina is a crucial part of how you advocate your case, and therefore if it has an avera acknowledgement in it, it shouldn't work for that reason. Okay, so far so good. Everyone following? All right. So I just want to add one more point, and then we'll dive in, and again we'll start from a new sugya tomorrow. But this issue came up—a very painful story that happened a few years ago. You might be too young to remember, but there was a very horrible scandal that you've all heard about, the issue of get refusal. And so you had a situation where a man can keep his wife chained up. It's obviously a tremendous avera, but it's theoretically possible to do, to keep his wife chained up by not giving her a get. So as bad as that is, there was a story a few years ago that was even worse, or threatened to be even worse, that there was a man who reached new levels of evil, and that he not only didn't want to give his wife a get, but to increase the leverage, so he claimed that he had a daughter who was a child, and since the Torah gives the father theoretically permission to marry off his daughter to someone else, he claimed that he had married off his daughter to somebody, and he's not going to say who, so he essentially made his daughter Raguna also, which is an even more complicated situation than his wife being in a gun. So the question was, so are we obligated to believe him? Maybe we should say that, okay, he claims this, but who cares? He doesn't have to believe that it actually happened. So there were many poskim who suggested, among many other svaras, not to believe him and not to acknowledge the whole situation, that he doesn't have credibility about this, because this is an act of enormous evil for many, many reasons, and therefore the whole statement shouldn't be believed, because they know the Mason Atzma Russia, and therefore you wouldn't acknowledge that such a thing ever could happen, because it's all based on his own testimony, and that shouldn't be valid in and of itself.
Almost,
I don't know if
you
know the person.
You said before that we discussed, if there's no doubt that he's in a variant from like something else, if he could actually make himself known.
Possibly, although not somebody who's in a variant would have to have done something like this.
So I'm saying, well, yeah. Here we already know that he was Russia from like refusing to get.
Right, which is bad enough, but this is probably like that squared.
So wouldn't that be a tzad to actually believe him? For
well, you still don't have, you don't necessarily have an undana that he did this kind. This is far worse. As bad as that is, right, this is even worse. So I don't know if that umdada would necessarily carry over.
It's interesting because this isn't an actual sin.
Well, I mean, it's clearly a Russia and
I think it's like more hashkafically.
No, but I mean, but causing that kind of tzara and asavar and that is an actual avera. It's just not defined in its own specific terms, but it certainly crosses the line of many, many psukim in the Torah. You're right that you need a little context to understand it, but so it's a little less defined. It's not its own pasuk, but it certainly enters into the category of not there. So,
it seems like it's a case of a debt rather than a case of a claim.
Why?
He's acknowledging the fact that this is I'd exchange my daughter for this guy, so I don't take care of her rights anymore.
Well, he's actually saying something worse than that. I mean, he's saying that he's not focusing on that. He's focusing on the fact that she's married to somebody else who she doesn't even know who it is or whatever, and he's not going to reveal that or take care of that unless he sorts his money.
So when you marry somebody off, you're saying that it's an exchange for his having to take care of her to exchanging that to somebody else.
That's also an element.
Like a debt, though. It's almost like he's getting rid of. It seems more like a vendette case to me than a claim case.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think it's both. I mean, it has that part, but it has the other components of it as well. So they're all, it's all relevant.
How does that fit into the claim case?
Because the fact that very claim itself is a massive aveira, regardless of whatever the consequences are in terms of taking care of it. But the claim itself is a massive act of evil, really a new depths of evil. So it's inherently... You can really ask also in terms of your own benign, it's interesting because, unfortunately, spouses, so when they separate, they can have tremendous bitterness towards each other. So we know that, but the idea that somebody's willing to put his child through such cruelty, really requires a whole new level of subhuman kind of evil, but it's hard to say that the first case tells you about the second case.
Couldn't you also say that there had to be some sort of exchange with someone else in taking part in the deal? So can you say that person at least, that you couldn't assume that person was that evil?
That person was not evil, or was he?
Enough to not come out and say who it was.
So that person is evil or isn't evil?
So he's not evil. So.
But even so, if we don't know who that is. Why do you have to believe that it happened? The whole story can be made up.
I'm saying, can't you use that as proof that it didn't happen?
Maybe because he's not coming forward and identifying himself? Maybe, unless he's in the plot. The whole point is that we don't know who it is, so he's benefiting from it. But again, that would make him evil. The issue is also discussed in the post-coming of the time, also discussed that any Aiden who would participate in such a scam have to, again, by definition, have to be evil. And how could you ever have such a process with Aiden that, by definition, you couldn't have kosher Aiden for such a thing? Rebbeich and others at the time suggested that whether or not this whole point is true, certainly for the possibility of it ever happening in the future, that society can put a clear chayrim on this and clearly identify to address Aryeh's point that this is subhuman behavior. And that anybody who would participate in such a thing is by definition possible aiders, and therefore it's practically impossible for that reason.
How good was that in Moscow?
It depends who you ask. I don't know exactly how the case was, but that was what many postkin advocated. One way or another, the situation was addressed. So whether that was the means for it or not, I don't remember. That was definitely an approach that was discussed. And certainly in terms of any future cases, that idea that there's a chayrim on it, once the idea was brought up, there's a chayrim on all future cases, it's more widely accepted. Okay, so just to quickly recap what we said in the past few minutes. So we recapped last week's material, and then we actually added that a couple of test cases. What if there's an umdun of the person who's telling the truth? What if the person is admitting to being amazed when he would otherwise be known as a shogeg? What if he didn't know it was an avera? And the question of likely exceptions, the exception of if it's not a, if it's not Aedus, but it's a taina, or it's a person identifying someone as his child. So both those cases were machlokas rishona. And the Bochanan asked about both cases, why don't we say it's clearly not an issue because it's not about Aedus. So Shechter in Eretz Tzvi asserts that we're not talking about Aedus really at all. Even though in Aedus, you have the issue of Karov, but even when it's not Aedus, you have a general principle here against self-incrimination, which is what the Pasuk is. Seventh Gemara is saying from the Pasuk of Asher Yarshiun, and that's why in our Sugya we find that even by an Emaris like Pesha Asar, it applies. And the question of the Machlokus Rishonim about a Taina, so you have to identify what that's talking about. So Modeh B'Knas, we know, is Pater. Hodos Baldin, we know, is Chayiv. This is an in-between case where a taina that somebody is advancing, that in that taina he's acknowledging an avera, so that was Machlok Shoshonim, which way to go. And maybe that's connected to the Rambam statement that a taina requires an explanation. So maybe the Machlokus is that the explanation become a part of the taina itself. So if that's an avera, it's not going to be good. Or do we say the taina really works on its own, the explanation is secondary, and therefore if that's an avera, it's not going to count. And then we talked about the infamous Kedusha Ketana case, and whether the father should be believed in such a situation, and that there were folks who asserted that by definition the father is not going to be believed because they know the Mesa Matzma Russia, and the person making such a claim would have to assert himself as being a Russia. Presumably that status would also apply to any Aiden who would validate such a procedure. And whether or not that svar is accepted, certainly any case afterwards should be subject to cheirim on such behavior, which should automatically mean that there's no possible way to have edus on the story, and therefore the situation is inherently impossible. So tomorrow, I want to talk about the pikuach nefesh components of the sugya, which will take us into a Chanukah connection. Again, the riddle's out there for anyone who figures out how it's going to take us to the Chanukah connection, but we'll segue into that tomorrow, and then take things from there. Good. Ashri, I'll show you this.